Hi, welcome to James Miller Lifeology, where you'll learn to simplify and transform your spirit, mind, and body. My name is James Miller. I'm a licensed psychotherapist and a composer. Thank you so much for joining me today in this podcast. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Get your free audiobook and a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/James Miller Lifeology. I have a great show for you today. I'll teach you how to ignore those unhealthy inner voices. I'll also be interviewing Dr. Glenn Livingston, who shares his own story of overcoming food addiction and the insight he has on ways to conquer this struggle. You all know me as a psychotherapist, but many of you do not know me as a composer. My first album, Consolation, was written specifically for people who are experiencing grief and loss. I like to think of this album like a book. Each original composition is written like a chapter in a book. And just like in any story, it goes from the loss that one experiences and eventually helps people find the hope for their future. You may purchase this album on iTunes or through any other digital music store. Be sure to download the digital booklet that comes along with it. The name of the album is Consolation, and my stage name is James S. Miller. The name of the piece you are currently hearing is entitled Temptation. And now it's time for self-check-in. It's important for us to be able to separate between what our body feels like and what our emotions are. Sometimes we think they're one and the same, but they're really not. So just because you may have woken up in a bad mood does not mean you can't fulfill the responsibilities that you have to do today. And vice versa, you may have woken up today and not feel very well, but that doesn't mean that you can't be in a good mood. So on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is the best you've ever felt and 1 is the worst you've ever felt. Go ahead and create those two scales for yourself. For example, for me, on a scale of 1 to 10, for my emotions, I'm feeling probably about an 8. I'm feeling pretty good. And then for my body, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm feeling about a 6. I got some good rest last night and I'm feeling pretty good. So since I realize that both of my numbers are higher than 5, it means I'm going to be pretty productive today, not only my emotions, but also my body. So when you can recognize that there's a difference between what your body feels like and what your emotions are, it helps you recognize what you can change. Ignoring your unhealthy inner voices. I'm sure we all remember when we're children, the cartoons that we would see where there's a person standing there, and then all of a sudden you see a little angel on one shoulder and a little devil on the other shoulder. And that's an analogy I typically like to use with my clients. The parts of us that are unhealthy, either it's a mindset or a behavior, that is kind of the version of what that little devil is. And of course, I don't mean this literally. I just mean this as an analogy. It's really important for us to separate between what is what. Have you ever noticed that some of the behaviors or thoughts that you have, you often say, these are mine. For example, my depression, my anxiety, my addiction. When you take ownership of something, it automatically becomes part of you. And when it becomes part of you, then we assume that there's nothing we can do to change it. But that's not true. When you can separate between what the behavior is from you, the person, it allows you to then make different choices or different mindsets. Whatever the thing may be for you, whether it's a behavior or a certain type of mentality, it's important to separate that. What I often like my clients to do is to write out a list of who are you? In other words, what are the attributes you demonstrate when you're very healthy? And sometimes if we struggle with that, we can say, well, how will people know when we're healthy? For example, if I struggle with a form of depression, when I'm not demonstrating depression, I look like this. I laugh more. I engage more with my friends. I am more gregarious. I'm more outgoing. I exercise more. So those are the attributes that I can say that's who James is, should I be struggling with depression. And then what you'll do is then you'll say, well, what are the attributes of that little devil, if you will, or that version of depression? And so you write down what attributes you demonstrate when you're experiencing that depression, and then that helps you separate between what is what. What are you and what is the depression? Because remember, we're not taking ownership of what that is. So it's really important for us to then say, all right, then the voice of that little devil, and once again, I don't mean that literally, but the voice of that depression, when it speaks to me, how can I discern what that voice sounds like? And it's really important for you to figure that out because once you start to engage in a behavior, you can say, wait a minute, that's not who I am. And since we don't take ownership of it, we can then say, that is the voice of depression. That is the voice of anxiety. That is the voice of overeating. That is the voice of an addiction. And that's what really helps you separate between what is what, and it helps you then determine what you're going to listen to. So once you have this awareness of what that thought is or what voice is speaking to you, and of course, I don't mean that literally, but that impression or the direction that it's trying to lead you in, you want to ask yourself, well, is this going to serve me? Is this behavior, or this mentality that I engage in, is that going to allow me to become the person I want to become a week from now, a year from now? And sometimes it's important for us to think this through as far as possible when it comes to the action we're about to do or with the mentality that we're going to enter a new situation. It's really difficult because often we struggle with separating between the two things. And then since we've done something for so long, it just becomes a learned behavior. For example, if that voice of anxiety subtly whispers to me and certain events, well, then all of a sudden I've trained myself that every time I go to this certain event, then I'm going to become nervous. I'm going to become anxious. And so after a while, all of a sudden that becomes who we think we are. And it's really not. It's something we've trained ourselves. And so that's why we say my anxiety, my depression, my addiction, because we've trained ourselves that it's now part of who we are. One of the things that's really important, and for those of you who have been a longtime supporter of James Miller Lifeology, you heard my first podcast episode, which is the 3-second rule, and I talk about how it only takes 3 seconds for us to self-sabotage. What I mean by that is this. So if I recognize that anxiety is whispering to me, if I don't stop that within 3 seconds, all of a sudden I'm going to listen to that voice of anxiety, and then I can get lost in that, and all of a sudden I'm anxious. Or for example, if I'm trying to do something different, I'm working on some self-introspection and all of a sudden I'm blindsided with the voice of depression, the voice of anxiety, and the voice of an addiction. If I don't catch that and say, that is not what I want to listen to, or that's not what's going to influence me, all of a sudden it's going to whisper louder and louder. And then that part of me, that little angel, if you will, all of a sudden is overshadowed by something that is so great because I go back to the default of what I'm used to listening to, of what I assume is a part of who I am, and it's not. So that's why I always tell people we have to be incredibly mindful of what we think, what we feel, what we do, and if we realize that it doesn't serve us, it's so important for us to catch it within 3 seconds. And of course, we're not always going to be able to do that. And we realize that in retrospect, that perhaps we listened or more influenced to those things that don't serve us. But the goal is to be able to practice and train ourselves that as soon as we feel something that we recognize is not who we are, that's an outside influencer like depression, anxiety, or some type of bad choices or unhealthy thinking, then we're able to say, that is not what I want to assimilate into my life. That is not the person I want to become. And so once again, I want to remind you to write down a list of who you are. Who are you when you don't experience these particular behaviors or thoughts that don't serve you? Is that the person you want to become? And if it is, then that is how you discern between who you really are and then who you are when you are influenced by these thought patterns or these behavioral patterns. And you can compare and contrast and see which one makes sense for you. And then that is how you know, either in the moment of, unfortunately, I'm engaging in a behavior I shouldn't engage in, and that is not who I want to become, or when we hear that voice that starts to influence us, we can say, no, that is not who I am, and I'm not going to engage in that behavior. So it's really empowering when you figure out who you are versus what that voice is. Who do you listen to? And now a quick word from my sponsor. For you, my listener, Audible.com is offering a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/James Miller Lifeology. Many of you don't know this about me, but I'm an avid reader. So this is a great opportunity for me to be able to download any book I'd like to read, specifically if I'm walking my dog at the gym or even driving. So for you to get your free audiobook, go to www.audibletrial.com/James Miller Lifeology. They have over 185,000 books for you to choose from. So I'm pretty confident you'll find the book you're looking for. So check it out today.
I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Glenn Livingston, who is a veteran psychologist and a longtime CEO of a multi-million dollar consulting firm, which has serviced several Fortune 500 clients in the food industry. You may have seen his or his company's previous work, theories, and research in major periodicals like the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Times, or any of the other major media outlets you can think of. You may also have heard him on ABC, WGN, and or CBS Radio. Disillusioned by what traditional psychology had to offer overweight and or food-obsessed individuals, Dr. Livingston spent several decades researching the nature of binging and overeating via work with his own patients and a self-funded research program with more than 40,000 participants. Today, Dr. Livingston is going to share his own personal, inspiring journey out of obesity and what he considered a food prison to a normal, healthy weight and a much more lighthearted relationship with food. Welcome to my show, Dr. Livingston.
Well, thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Yes, thank you so much for joining with us today. Not only are you a psychologist, but it sounds like you had also struggled with obesity as well. Would you like to tell my listeners about your personal journey?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. It's a little embarrassing, but because I sometimes think, I don't know if you feel like this, but I sometimes feel like as a psychologist, we're really supposed to understand all these issues and have gotten ahead of the game, right?
I totally understand that. Yes. As everyone should know, that we're all people just like everyone else, and we all have our own pitfalls and struggles, that's for sure.
And the pizza box looks just as good no matter what you know about what's going on inside your brain.
It's very true. Very true.
Yeah. I suppose that I would be best described as what you'd call an exercise bulimic, meaning that I never purged. I could never get around the idea of sticking my finger down my throat, but I loved food. I'm a relatively big guy. If I exercised a lot, I could stay thin in my adolescence and early adulthood. So I exercised an hour or two every day, and I'd eat whatever I wanted to. And I mean, you know, I don't know how I survived college with the kinds of things that I eat. And I don't remember when I learned what a vegetable was, but but it was okay. It worked for me while I was in college. But I want to say it worked for me. I think in retrospect, I could have been pursuing more significant things with my time. Sure. I could have been more involved with relationships. I could have been more involved in accomplishing something valuable that would help the world, as opposed to burning the candle on both ends physically. But that's why they say youth is wasted on the young, right?
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Yeah. And so as I got older and I had responsibilities, I became a psychologist and I started a practice. And because we didn't have kids and we didn't commute, I also started doing some marketing consulting around the psychological motivation to purchase. And I had some good connections through my wife, and I was successful on both fronts there. So I had a lot of responsibilities, and you can't be exercising so hard and then eating so much and sleeping it off when that's the case.
Of course. And well, not only that, but as you get older as well, your metabolism changes. I mean, that's how we looked when we were perhaps in our early 20s is not necessarily how we're going to look and be able to maintain the same schedules we had then versus what we have now.
Absolutely. Right. And so I started gaining weight. I stopped exercising as much. I started gaining weight, and I found it very difficult to stop eating the same way that I was eating. So I kind of kept eating the same way I was, but I didn't exercise, and I lost weight, and I gained weight. And, you know, it wasn't horrendous at first. It was noticeable, but not horrendous. I think I went from, like, 185 pounds to 205 pounds or something like that. But as the stress mounted, I was a couples and family therapist, and I sometimes if you work with couples, the kids, the children in those families, if there was a very severe conflict, sometimes they really take the brunt of it. And so there were a number of suicidal teenagers that I started working with, and the stress really started to mount. And I noticed that I felt a little more compelled to eat pizza and chocolate and pasta and all my lovelies. And the height of it was probably a little before 9/11, when I started to feel like I was just thinking about food too much, and I felt guilty, like I should really be more concentrated on my patients or more concentrated on the client work that I was doing. You know, and I did a good job with everybody. I never lost anyone, and most people would say they're really happy that I was their doctor.
Yeah, of course.
But I felt guilty. I felt guilty. And when 9/11 came around, we were in New York, and we had taken on a really big business risk. And it went totally south in New York. And like a long story short, we lost millions of dollars that we didn't have. We had all these obligations, and we were deep in debt, and I had no idea how I was ever going to pay that back. And I was thinking about bankruptcy, and I just went hog wild with food to escape. And so I wound up around 260 pounds, and my triglycerides were like 1,100, and the doctors were yelling at me. And I tried all kinds of things to intervene. So, I mean, I went to my own psychologist and I tried to figure out what psychological issues I really need to deal with. I went to Overeaters Anonymous for a couple of years, and it kind of helped, but it made me more frightened. And like eventually when I lost it, it was worse.
What do you mean when you lost it? What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you go to Overeaters Anonymous, they tell you to have three meals a day with nothing in between, and everything is weighed and measured. And
oh, I see. So when you fell off the wagon, if you will, that type of...
When I fell off the wagon, when there was that piece of chocolate staring at me from the Starbucks counter that said, hey, chocolate grows on a... Cocoa beans grow on a plant, and a plant is a vegetable, and so chocolate's really...
Of course, it works. I'm laughing because I've justified things like that before too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a long story short, what I found was what was more valuable was recognizing that crazy voice inside of me. And I had started looking into, so it wasn't necessarily this deep psychodynamic psychotherapy, which provided a lot of other value. And there were a lot of interesting things I learned about when I craved this food or that food, but it didn't help to stop it. What really helped to stop it was I was exposed to an addiction treatment called Rational Recovery. Mm-hmm. And in that, he really talks about dealing with that voice inside of you. You know, he's really focused on the black and white addictions like alcohol and smoking and heroin and things like that. I think you can cut out of your life entirely. I found that it didn't really work 100% for food, and I had to make a lot of modifications. But eventually, I mean, this is almost embarrassing to say as a sophisticated psychologist and someone with all my credentials, but this is what worked for me. What worked for me, James, was to say, I'm going to make a really clear plan about what's on my plan and what's off my plan so that if 10 people follow me around all day long, they'd know if I was on the plan. So, for example, I wanted to just give up chocolate. I was never going to have chocolate again. And if 10 people followed me around, they would know whether I had chocolate or not.
Okay.
And I said, there's this voice inside of me. I'm going to call it the pig. Women don't really like when I do that. But I'm going to call it the pig. And any voice that I hear that suggests that I might have any chocolate either now or in the future is going to be pig squeal.
Okay.
And chocolate itself is going to be pig squeal. Whenever I just started listening for that voice, and that's what worked. That's what worked. It wasn't perfect, but that's what works. And I started kind of codifying it and figuring out the different ways you could set up the rules. And then I started helping some of my clients to set up rules for themselves and listen for their inner pig. And
what I'm hearing is you went ahead and you quantified and you measured. So this is the measurable objective. If I eat this, obviously this is black and white, then I've not met my goal for the day. So 10 people following me, the measurement is, do I eat it or do I not eat it? Or do they see me eat it? Do they not see me eat it? So you broke it down to very black and white of, do I do it or do I not do it? And then you use that internal voice of kind of that personification of, is this on my plan or is it off my plan? If it's off my plan and it's I have this compulsion to eat it or this thoughts to eat it, then that is the voice of the pig. And so that's not necessarily my voice, but since that's the voice of the pig, that's really how you measured it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. And I didn't have to have any answers for the voice. I just had to recognize that it was squeal. And I don't listen to farm animals to tell me what to do. So why should I just not ignore it? The part that's kind of important, though, is that the rules don't have to be as strict. So it doesn't have to be that I never eat chocolate. It could be that I never eat chocolate during the week. And then those 10 people could still follow me around and it would be black and white. Or it could be I don't eat chocolate on Mondays. What I tell people is, it's like if you were a city planner, what you want to do is figure out where you need stoplights and stop signs, but you only want to put down as many as you need, and you don't want to put down a stoplight if a stop sign would do, because you're trying to maximize the freedom and enjoyment that you get from food. But life is difficult, and food is a nice thing. But it has to be 100% clear so there's no ambiguity, because ambiguity is the pig's best friend.
And somehow we can justify it.
Yes. If you say that you only eat vegetables, and then the pig is going to find some way to convince you that chocolate is a vegetable. If you haven't said that you never have chocolate, then before you know it, you're going to be thinking that chocolate. I actually really thought that one time. only for a split second, but it just takes a split second, you know?
It really does. It really does. But I really like that analogy you use of a stoplight versus a stop sign. I think, I mean, for me, that makes sense. And, you know, as far as we're never going to do this versus we're going to pause and we're going to reflect and we're going to see what makes sense for us in this moment.
Yeah. And then the work comes in artfully identifying what your future might look like under various conditions with various rules. Mm-hmm. So usually if someone comes to me to talk about what to do with chocolate or overeating chocolate, they're ambivalent about whether they want to give it up entirely or they just want to have some type of limiting rule on it so that they feel safe. And one of the ways we figure that out is I say, well, let's not commit to anything just yet. Let's decide not to decide and explore a couple of possibilities. And if we were to look at your life in a year and you hadn't had any chocolate whatsoever and you committed to being the kind of person who never has chocolate again, then what would happen? What would I see? And what would you be like physically? And would you be wearing different clothes, and what would your friendships and your career and your house and your, let's examine your whole life and really look at what you anticipate the benefits would be. And then I'll say, well, now let's step it down and let's look at, well, what if you only had chocolate on Saturdays? What would it look like? Mm-hmm. And you kind of compare and contrast. It's really surprising how easily people can envision what their future is like and just paint that whole picture. And if you compare and contrast the different futures, the choice becomes pretty clear. And you know, and then we can help people to decide whether they want a conditional rule or a strict rule, or sometimes, by the way, it's the rule about something you're always going to do. Like, I'm always going to start the day with 16 ounces of pure, fresh spring water, or always going to take my vitamins, or I'm always going to walk around the block before I do anything else, or something like that.
So a morning ritual of some sort.
Yeah. Yeah, or it could be an all-day ritual. Some people say, I'm always going to have 6 servings of fruit and vegetable. The point I'm trying to make is that it's easy to get carried away with the restriction when you recognize that something so simple could have so much power, and you actually have the ability to excise these things from your life if you really want to. It's easy to get carried away with this restriction, and I like people to know that they can also add things to their plans. So, yeah, so I mean, if we got back to my story, then this kind of strange idea took hold in my head, and I started to think of alter ego as the pig, and I listened very carefully for it. And I made mistakes over time, but the voice got clearer and clearer, and my ability to control it got better and better, to the point that I really became a person who just doesn't have chocolate. I just really became that kind of person, and it became effortless, and I no longer craved it. You know, I dropped down to a normal weight. I have no trouble really maintaining it. You know, there are times, just like an athlete, that I'll peak and I'll get down to a really low body fat and I'll be a little loose on purpose, but my life is a lot better.
Did you find a lot of this had to do with your coping strategies or coping skills?
Again, strangely, no. The relationship to the coping skills was how it affected my comfort level.
Okay.
And so what I like to tell people is, all you really have to do to never binge again is never binge again. You don't really... I want you to develop coping skills. You know, I'm a psychologist. I think that's really important. The mistake that people make is thinking that they have to wait until they've developed the coping skills before they can change the behavior. So, for example, in the early days when I was trying to figure this all out, I actually funded a very large study on personality and food preference. And I had people take a little personality inventory, and then I had them tell me what types of food they tended to have trouble controlling. And I found that there was a relationship between people who were prone to feeling lonely or isolated and chocolate. And I kind of identified with that myself. And I found there was a relationship between people who were feeling very stressed at work and carbohydrates, pasta and rice and things like that, bread. And I found there was a relationship between people that were feeling very anxious and salty snack chips.
Interesting.
And I thought it is really interesting, and it makes a really good jumping off point for a soulful exploration.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was really going to have something there, and that as soon as I knew someone was having trouble with chocolate, I could zero in on where were they feeling isolated in their life, and could I help them develop more intimacy. And
so almost like a diagnostic assessment.
It's a weird diagnostic assessment.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's a little useful in that respect, but what I found was that people would say, oh, I get it. So I'm eating chocolate because I'm lonely. So let's solve the loneliness problem. And in the meantime, I'm going to keep eating chocolate. And that was that crazy voice again.
Okay. Yeah. So somehow it's so rationalized.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, every psychologist knows it's easier to work on the coping skills that people are enacting out. So if they're not aggressively gratifying themselves with something that takes away the uncomfortable feelings, then the uncomfortable feelings and thoughts are more accessible for a psychologist to work with. So there's definitely a relationship, but I think that what happens in our culture is that there's a real emphasis on figuring out the emotional problems in order to solve the physical problems, and I actually think it works the other way.
Well, I think sometimes just over-processing something and trying to figure out the whys of it really stops us from being able to just live in the moment and change our behavior in the moment.
You know, it took me so long to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
I was brought up in a family of, my parents are both psychologists, and my aunts and uncles and cousins. There are 17 people in my family that are in the helping profession.
Wow.
And I always joke, You don't really want to come to a family reunion.
I was thinking that, yeah. That would not be something, someplace I'd probably want to go for dinner.
Right. Everybody argues. It's really funny. But I joke with people that, like, I don't know much about fixing up the house. Mm-hmm. I don't know much about fixing up the car, but I could ask it how it feels. And that was just my orientation to life all the way through my early 40s. I just thought that psychology was the answer to everything. And there are just some things where you're much better off having a practical solution and dealing with psychology later, if at all. I mean, there's some things it doesn't matter if you know why. Like, who cares why you eat chocolate? I know how to stop.
Yeah, exactly. And you focus on what you can do versus what you can't do.
Yeah. I guess the one thing I'd like to say is that in addition to the paradigm shift of changing the behavior and letting the psychology follow, as opposed to digging deep for the psychology and waiting until it's fixed for the behavior to follow, the other paradigm shift had to do with the idea that it was kind of difficult to love yourself thin. I think there's a lot of emphasis in our culture that we need to heal our inner wounded child in order to stop overeating. My experience, and certainly the experience of a lot of the people that I talk to, which I tend to attract these kind of people because of what I talk about, but is that there's a certain type of overeating where getting better, it's more like capturing and caging a rabid dog than nurturing an inner wounded child back to health. And you kind of have to separate from this part of yourself that really wants to obtain this particular type of toxic pleasure at all costs and is willing to destroy all your goals and aspirations and best laid plans. And it's not a very lovable part of ourselves. It's really, really just a part of the lizard brain that's run amok, right? It's, you know, our neurology is wired in order to control that lizard brain so that we can have relationships and accomplish goals and make long-term plans and, you know, live the life of our dreams. I think that it's a mistake to try and love that part of yourself until you can control it. I think the people that suffer from the kind of overeating that I suffered with, where you feel like you could just dislodge your jaw, like there's a switch that snaps inside of you and you could dislodge your jaw and empty the delicatessen into it, that's a real dysfunction of the control of the lizard brain. And I really think that it's necessary to cage and control that like a rabid animal rather than loving it back to health.
Okay. So that's essentially where you come back to, I can stop this. I will stop this. Going back to the plan that you had, is this the voice of me, the person, or is this the voice of that rabid dog, if you will, trying to control me? And so who's going to win?
Right. And once you do that, it's a fairly easy choice because there are all sorts of things that we control that lizard brain about. You know, like, like most of us don't worry about cravings when it comes to robbing banks. It's not like we pass by a bank and say, oh my God, I'm going to have to rob a bank today. We're just not the case, right?
Yeah, that's not the case, yes.
But because we're just not the kind of people that rob banks. We decided at some point that we're not bank robbers and we don't rob banks. And it kind of bothered me that you can decide that, or you know, we don't run up to really attractive people on the street and kiss them, right? I mean, we have those impulses. That's part of being human.
Sure.
But we learn to control those impulses so we don't get in trouble and so that we can keep to our commitments and everything like that. And, you know, if we make a wedding vow, what we don't do is say, you know, I'm about 80% certain I can be faithful for you forever, but there sure are a lot of attractive people out there. And I'm just being honest. I don't know. I might slip at some point. You know, it's we decide we want to be a married person. And if we're not willing to make that commitment, then our spouse will reject us. And I don't see why we can't do the same with food. I don't see why we can't decide we're the kind of person that only eats chocolate on the weekends, or we're the kind of person that has six servings of fruit and vegetables every single day for the rest of our life. The message in society is really that you can't do that. You can only, you know, aim for progress, not perfection, and aim for abstaining one day at a time and just do the best you can. And, you know, I think it's good to be kind-hearted to ourselves if we do make a mistake. But when we're out to accomplish a goal or climb a mountain, I think we should be visualizing the top of that mountain, committing every essence of our being to reaching the top of the mountain and purging all doubt and uncertainty from our mind. And if you happen to fall down, then get up and be kind to yourself and try again, figure out what went wrong. You know, there's no point to beating yourself up and making yourself feel like a weakling, because that's actually counterproductive.
Sure. Well, I think you make a very valid point. Yes, we have those, potentially we do have those impulses, but we don't act on them. That's a very logical statement that you made of, well, then why do we have these impulses with food, but yet we don't stop it? And I think that's a very valid point that you make. And it makes sense for me, and I'm sure it makes sense to my listeners as well, that with things we wouldn't do with other people, why do we do that in other areas of our life?
Right. And I think it's because as a civilization, we've made a compromise. We've said that living together in the way that we do, we're not meant to sit in buildings with four walls around us, staring at an electronic computer screen, bread on the savannah, and we're not really living the lives that we were originally meant to live. And so we figured out how to eliminate the obsession with hunting and gathering by having ready sources of dense calories available to us at all times, you know, dense calories in the smallest packages possible for the least money possible. And we all kind of made that compromise. When you analyze it and you think about what's really best for you, still can be a really good decision to make.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's one of the things, you know, overall when it comes to society in general. Like you said, we have basic rules, and sometimes in our minds, we create our own set of rules. And so we present a certain way, but then when we're by ourselves, we present a different way. I think that's a lot of times where the binge eating component really shows its face is when we're by ourselves. And then all of a sudden that links with a different component of shame, of guilt. As we reintegrate into society again, and we put on that face and we try and just go through our day, but it's those two parts are typically warring all the time.
Yeah. But the thing about this really piercing insight is that even though the deck is stacked against us, I mean, the food industry is engineering these incredibly hyper-palatable foods with, you know, lower levels of nutrients and higher levels of calories and satisfaction. And even though, you know, the message in the culture is that you can't really resist indefinitely, you can only do the best you can and abstain and progress is not perfection. Even though it's all kind of wired against us in that way, when you suddenly step back and you say, no, hey, wait a minute, there's two parts of my brain or three parts of my brain, and I'm in control. This upper part of my brain where I live, where my goals and dreams and aspirations live, that's in control. And mm-hmm. I can actually resist any impulse if I really want to. I just have to identify it and recognize it and say, no, not now. That's not what I'm doing. I don't do that. It's amazing what's actually possible, even in the face of society that encourages food addiction and is upset with us when we eat progressively more healthy.
Well, I really like the way you separate that as far as the higher functioning brain and then the amygdala, the lizard part of our brain. I really like how you separate those two, because when we think of it in the higher brain functioning, as far as our hopes and dreams and how we want to be successful in life, we can definitely separate between the more animal part of our brain. And I think that that's a really good reminder of how to do that, because sometimes we just think of it all as one. And I really like that you are able to separate that, because it's true. If we decide to compartmentalize those two things, we can always live in the compartment that's going to serve our needs and not fall into some type of food addiction or behavioral compulsion or some type of addiction in general.
That's exactly how it works.
Now, you have a book on your website that I think my listeners would really like to hear more about. Do you want to tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, the book is called Never Binge Again, and it outlines this philosophy, but with a lot more detail and examples, specifically of the different things that my pig, other people's pigs, called your fat-thinking alter ego, different things that it says that it might say to trick you and how you can overcome it. The book is free. I did this initially as kind of a social engineering kind of a project. And so if you go to neverbingeagain.com, you can click on the free book button or the reader bonuses book button, and I download the book free from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or you get all the best links right at neverbingeagain.com. If you have any trouble doing that, just write to our support and we'll get your PDF copy. But
wonderful. That's actually something I will definitely take a look at that myself and be sure to read it. Now, if my listeners want to find out more information about you specifically, where would they find your information online?
Well, my biography is on neverbingeagain.com. They also might, if they sign up for the reader bonuses, they're going to hear a whole bunch of specific case studies. So I've got a lot of coaching clients who allow me to record them going through this technique and demonstrate so that people could kind of work it out for themselves. To also get a bunch of free starter food plan templates for some ideas, for some rules that might work for them or not. I think it's really important that everybody develops their own plan and I don't just become some other diet guru or something like that.
No, I really like that. In fact, I really like that you have the case studies there as well, because I think anybody can find one of those case studies that's kind of similar to themselves, maybe with some of the struggles they have. So I think that's a wonderful additional tool that my listeners will be able to use.
Yeah, because there's only so much theory you can talk, right? Theory that people can absorb before they really want to hear what what actually happened. And that's why we did that.
Yes, well, that makes sense. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Livingston, for being a part of my show. I know that you gave my listeners a lot of insight to think about. I know you gave me some things to think about as well for myself as far as how to compartmentalize those my higher functioning brain as far as some of those basic cravings that I may have. So I really want to thank you once again for being a part of James Miller Lifeology today.
Well, James, you know, I want to thank you for having such an inspiring show.
Thank you so much.
I'd also like to thank you, the listener, for joining with me today. Please subscribe to this podcast, either through iTunes or through whichever podcast portal you joined with me today. Also, please visit my website, jamesmillerlifeology.com. You may enroll in the Lifeology Academy I created. They're self-directed courses for successful people just like you. You may also see all the Lifeology YouTube episodes I've created. Currently, there are over 135 episodes for you to watch. And also on my website, you may find many other tools and techniques which will help you simplify and transform your spirit, mind, and body. Have an amazing week, and I'll talk to you very soon.